Hi, I'm Nino Ricci, the Alice Munro Chair in Creativity at Western University, and this is Who Do You Think You Are? Each episode, we talk to someone from the Western community who is making a difference in their field by challenging old assumptions or forging new models for how we make sense of the world. These are people who are showing us that creativity lies at the heart of innovation in any field, whether it be business or law or history or the sciences or the arts. They're also showing us how creative solutions often come from building bridges across the disciplines and breaking down the barriers that often blind us to new approaches. Today we're speaking with Jeremy Copeland from Western's Faculty of Information and Media Studies. Jeremy, you come to teaching with a pretty impressive resume. You were journalist for 15 years with networks like CBC, BBC, Al Jazeera. You helped run the first election in Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein. You've covered stories like 9/11, the war in Afghanistan, Hurricane Katrina, the nuclear standoff between India and Pakistan. You've interviewed people like the Dalai Lama. It's pretty impressive.
Thank you.
Now, what for you sticks out in that as, I guess, the most exciting work that you did over that period?
That's a hard one because I'd have to actually sit and think a long time. And I'm not sure there's one that stands out, but there are many exciting things that exciting moments for me that I had over the course of those 15 years of working as a journalist. And not this, they would all be for different reasons. One that jumps to mind is just getting the experience. I mean, overall, having the experience of telling stories and sharing stories and gathering stories. I guess it's about hearing people's stories. And I'm a bit of an introvert. I was one of the quietest people when I was a student in class. I'd never talk. And so to be able to have the power to go out, the privilege to go out and gather people's stories, like just ask them about whatever I want, be invited into their homes, be invited to hear about their lives. So to be able to take that and then turn around and share those stories with other people is great. And maybe throw an example of something, one of those experiences, like when I lived in India for 2 years, I'd have people, friends sometimes come through backpacking, seeing the country. And the experience that they would get of getting to know the culture of the country is so different than the experience of living there and being a journalist in the country like that. So. And now, maybe this wouldn't appeal to some people, but like, sorry.
Does it matter if you're interviewing the Dalai Lama or just the guy in the street? I mean, which one of those ends up being the meatier interview for you?
Way more. I mean, meatier for my career, the Dalai Lama. No question about it. That's what we're still talking about. But from a personal point of view, going to somewhere like Bhopal and meeting the people who live in the slums around the factory at Bhopal, which is where the world's worst industrial disaster happened, thanks to an American company that had lax standards, and there was a huge gas leak. It killed thousands of people and is still experiencing huge repercussions today because of it, because it was never cleaned up, the mess. So to go into the slum next to the Union Carbide factory, meet people, be invited into their homes, a tourist doesn't get to go to a slum. They doesn't get to hear about the challenge that these people face of either going to the well and pumping water from a well that has a sign that is clearly marked in their language saying this water is not safe to drink, and they have to go home and feed it to their kids because it's 45 degrees outside and kids have to drink water or they're going to die. Everybody has to drink. So you're drinking poisoned water, knowing you're drinking poisoned water with no alternatives. And I think when I was there, that was the 20th anniversary of that disaster, still going on today, even 15 years after that.
Wow.
So telling those stories is what feels so just mean everyday people rather than government ministers or even the Dalai Lama, although that was kind of special too.
Yeah, I can imagine a bit stressful also interviewing someone like the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, for many reasons. One, the biggest reason is that there's so much pressure on you because people expect things. Getting that interview is hard and it takes a lot of time and it's a lot of traveling. And then the Globe, at that point, because I was freelancing, I had told the Globe and Mail I'd provide them with a story, CBC Radio, CBC TV, BBC Radio wanted a story for me about that. CBC Online was going to have me do a story for them about that. So there's a lot of people sort of counting on me to not screw up, make sure my batteries are working so I record the interview properly, all those little things. So that's stressful. The actual interview itself was surprised. I mean, that's probably one of the most nervous times I've ever been for an interview. But once it gets going, he was so humble and put me at ease so fast that as long as I could ignore the pressure of the demands that were expected from me in terms of output, it was not stressful at all. It was kind of a fun experience of interviewing him.
You're a young journalist. You're thrown out in the field, and you have all these pretty intense experiences, ones you couldn't have foreseen what it would be like to be in Bhopal and meet these people and see that in front of your eyes. Clearly, it's going to affect you in some way, and you must have had a lot of experiences like that. What's kind of the cumulative effect of that over time as you're going out in the field?
There's different moments where it's hard or stressful, where you might feel traumatized by covering the hard story, and that could be even a story in Canada. It doesn't have to be out off doing something super exotic or in a different location. I've never really thought about the cumulative effect on what it has on me. I mean, it's just one thing it does is it leaves me with a lot of good stories, which is one of the things I love about hearing people's stories. It leaves me with stories that I can share with people at different times in my life. And it's why I continue to like to collect good stories, because that's what I like to do. Usually I don't talk a lot about myself. This is a different experience. And I usually share other people's stories. It doesn't, I mean, individual experiences might traumatize you sometimes, but other individuals' experiences just leave you feeling fantastic. And when you get a nice note from somebody whose family has heard your story and it's made a big difference in their lives, to hear that story and to understand what their family members were going through, that feels very enriching and rewarding. So there's those highs and lows throughout it, with a lot of stress thrown in as well, just in terms of collecting the stories.
And where do you position yourself as the journalist? I mean, how attached can you get? Do you have to maintain a kind of objective distance in order to report well, or do you end up sort of attaching in a way that inevitably, in some ways, got to influence the way you tell a story?
That's an interesting question, because I think that changed over time. I think when I started, I was much more detached. And I was, like a lot of men, grew up, this is my generation, grew up kind of taught to be emotionally shut down, stay calm, not show emotions, you know, don't cry, don't let it out. That served me really well early on in my career, going into a control room to direct entire newscasts when breaking news was happening, and just being able to stay calm through that. What I learned as I did more journalism and did more sort of learn about myself is letting yourself go to a place where you do let out your emotions and connect with people more, the people you're interviewing, hearing their stories and actually feeling it rather than just collecting it in sort of a detached way, ended up getting me way better interviews, way better clips, and did affect me on a different level in a positive way, and also a positive way. I mean, but sometimes a negative way is too hard a word to say it, but sometimes it would have an impact on me. So one story that I can think of with that happening is telling a story about a woman in Vancouver who's son was shot and killed in a gang drug dealer hit, basically. They came, she was living in a middle-class neighborhood, pent floor of a nice apartment building in Vancouver, and had no idea a drug dealer was living across the hall from her. One day she asked her son to stay home to meet the guy who was going to come and fix something in the house. So her son skipped basketball practice, stayed home, and heard noise across the hallway, went across to check out the noise. People were being executed across the hallway, and he got killed as well. So 2 years later, I show up because I want to do a story. It was before the Olympics in Vancouver, and there was a lot of gang violence going on, and people were worried that was going to affect the Olympics a year later. And I show up to her into her life and ask her to tell me about her story of gang violence and what the impact that has, that idea of trying to find one human face to talk about gang violence. And I walked into her home, the same apartment that she lived in with her son, which is still 2 years later was a memorial to her son. There was pictures all up over the walls of her son. There was candles. There were all the notes that had been written after he died that people had left for him. Very much stuck 2 years ago in the life of her son and his death. And it was nice to be able to hear that. It was also really hard to hear it. It was hard to, afterwards she invited me to the cemetery, so we went to the cemetery with her to go sit where she sits almost every day with her son. And to see this woman whose life was stuck 2 years was stuck where it was almost 2 years ago because of a death that happened unfairly to her son. And to sort of experience that trauma and to see her stuck. Yes, she's doing some positive things, and I've had that in the story, and that was the message of the story. She's speaking out to try to make sure other mothers don't have to experience this and want the police to be tougher on gang violence. But she's also very much stuck in her life. And I remember leaving that interview, spending a whole day with her, and leaving it and just feeling sad, traumatized from it. Nice that I could help her share her story, but traumatized from experience, secondhand trauma.
And from her perspective, do you think there was value for her in you showing up and essentially kind of packaging her trauma in a way that it could be digested by the public? Was that something that helped her in her?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point for people who think about journalism, but also people who want to do journalism. Like, why are we going out and talking to these people and asking them to relive their trauma? Why am I inviting this woman, or going with this woman, to the cemetery to sit with her dead son? And there's huge value for her. I was in touch with her for a few months afterwards. She was very grateful that I came and did the story, mm-hmm. because by sharing that story, I'm helping validate, give her son's life meaning. Mm-hmm. Her son died way too young, but at least if something positive can come out of that, which she's really trying to her credit, really trying to do, I'm part of that. I'm part mm-hmm. of empowering her to make her son's life mean something. And I have a personal experience with that too, that I share with my students sometimes about, I mean, I wouldn't want to do that. Not all of us want to share that, those stories. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't the first person I tried to contact for that story. I contacted a few people. She was the one who wanted to share her story. My niece in Sweden, so my in-laws, she got sick with cancer and died when she was 10. And I remember thinking when she was really sick, and even afterwards, like, that's a horrible thing. That's awful. And if I was that family, I would just keep it quiet. But her family, my in-laws, my brother-in-law and his wife, they shared it publicly. They wanted people to know about it. They actually, like, went on a TV show that they came and spent an hour with them, showed her in the hospital, showed them at home, and helped people understand what it's like to live with a child like that, and also see how wonderful her life was, even though there she was struggling with cancer. So they were very happy to be able to share their story. And the journalists who did that in Sweden were helping them. They were doing them a service mm-hmm. by making some sense of that tragedy that was happening to them and occurring to them.
So now you're in a classroom, you have all this experience. So how do you teach your students to recognize that difference between the moment that's intrusive and the one that's actually useful and respectful?
Good question. I guess, I mean, one part is just, I think most of us do that intuitively anyways. Mm-hmm. I think most of us are very shy about asking about hard things for good reason. But as a journalist, again, that is your license, but it's not just that you're allowed to do it. It is your responsibility to do it. If somebody like Eileen Mohan, the woman in Vancouver, wants to share her story about her son and it's important to her, I'm not doing her a favor by not asking her the tough questions. I'm mm-hmm. doing her a huge disservice because she wants that story to be told. So if my students are out there and they're too nervous to ask tough questions, and I don't mean questions because they're not mean, they're just emotional questions, then they're doing a disservice to the person who's been so brave and so, you know, considerate of sharing their story with the student, and not just with the student, with everybody who's following the student who's going to be reading that story. So I encourage them to do that. I make it very, I try to say very clearly, look, if somebody doesn't want to talk, you do not push them. You make them, you let them know you're available to talk. You want to share their story. You want to hear their story and share it. But do not push that at all. Because if somebody like Eileen Mohan doesn't want to share her story and she doesn't respond to my email, that's fine. I'm not going to call her and try to talk her into it. That would mm-hmm. be disrespectful. But once they say they want to share their story, it would be doing them a disservice by not telling it fully.
Okay, so you've been out in the field. It must be both, I guess, gratifying to be doing that work and exhilarating at times to be covering, you know, stories with that kind of depth, and also stories that you know, make the major headlines. And now you're in a classroom in London. Is that a bit of a letdown? What brought you here, and what different things are you getting out of teaching?
What brought me here is love.
Uh-huh.
It's a good reason to move to London, Ontario, after living in places like London, England. I'm trying to think of the places I lived directly before that. Toronto, London, England, New Delhi, Washington, D.C., Baghdad, Washington, D.C. again, and then London, Ontario. So yeah, it was I'm not sure I would call it a letdown, but it was a shock to move to London, Ontario, and to try to cover international news from London, Ontario for an international news organization, because there's not a lot of international news in London, Ontario. But I came here for love. My wife was teaching at Fanshawe College. She's an artist and taught fine art there. So I came here for her from Washington, D.C., and made it work by first covering all of Canada sort of as a foreign correspondent for Al Jazeera English, and then for a couple of years, and traveling a lot, because that's what you had to do if you're going to be an international journalist in London, Ontario. And then shifting into teaching. And I always liked teaching. and
now,
not...
I hear that you were not an especially good student.
Have you been looking at my transcripts from Western? I was a solid B student. And by solid means I was very hardworking and not a good worker. So I worked really hard and got Bs. I didn't get a single, let alone A, I didn't get a single A minus. Like nothing, I never broke the 70s in 4 years at Western. So not a strong student, but not super weak. B, right in the middle of the pack, despite how hard I worked. So yeah, no, when I was a student, I could not imagine that I would be a teacher. I was also super quiet. So the idea of standing up in front of a classroom never occurred to me as something, gee, I want to do that. Like, no, never at all.
So what changed?
I think I've always liked, I mean, again, it comes back to teaching. And it's not teaching and standing in front of a classroom and being a teacher. It's teaching people about what I've learned. Mm-hmm. Like when I would learn new things, I get excited about them and I want to share that. And so when I think it started at the BBC where I got my first opportunity to do some training with some of the younger journalists. And I wasn't that old then, but I was a little bit older than them, had a few more years of experience at that point. And I was also a really good writer because at the CBC, they drill people on writing and they really value writing. And at the BBC, World Television at the time, they didn't. They just turned things around really quickly. So I was I went from being a very good writer at the CBC, not top five by any stretch of the imagination. I had friends, Marianne Policelli, Dave Freeman, who were on the desk with me, who were great writers, and people over at the National writing for Peter Mansbridge, who were excellent writers. But at the BBC, I was one of the best writers in the newsroom for sure. So I got to train young people, and that was fun because I just like teaching people. That was one-on-one. So It's a big difference from what we might picture, well, what I do now. But that idea of teaching I always really liked, of teaching people one-on-one. Somehow I've made the leap to being in front of the classroom, and that was not easy.
I think one of the reasons we chose you as the first interview for this series was that you have a lot of experience in interviewing, and I don't.
Right.
And they kind of hoped I might learn something from you. So here's your chance for some one-on-one teaching. What can you tell me about how to conduct an interview that I can carry forward?
All right. So the first thing would be, what is the platform you're interviewing on? So TV interviews are different than print interviews, different than radio interviews. But I'll give you some general ones for a podcast that'll work well because let's say that's your goal. Let's keep it targeted and focused. Few things. One, do your research beforehand. So you shouldn't be going in blind. You should be doing it. Ideally, you'd have you or somebody else would do a pre-interview just to have a sense of what the person's going to talk about.
So I need a good producer is what you're telling
me. You need a good producer, okay. Yes. That's a good idea. Not everybody has that luxury, so sometimes you have to be your own good producer. But if you've got a Jeff sitting behind you, all the better. So there's that. So have a good idea of the questions. This is a key one. And my experience of being on the other side of the microphone when I did the Iraq elections, I was amazed by how poor people's skills are at this. Listen.
So don't be looking at my notes all the time. I should actually pay attention to what you're saying.
Yes. You can look away at your notes. Do not be sitting there thinking like a lot of people do in conversations. What am I going to ask next? Or that's not where your focus should be. Listen. Because the person who you're talking to, if it's a challenging interview, if you're interviewing a politician and they're trying to keep information from you, they might not give you they might not answer your question. They might sit there and talk for 2 minutes after you ask them the question. They haven't answered your question. They probably told you something they want to tell you anyways and completely dodged asking your question. So, and on the other flip side, if you hear something that you didn't know about somebody who has experienced something difficult in their lives and they tell you something really open and honest, and then you ask about something totally different and you don't pick up on that, that person picks that up. Mm-hmm. And they will respond by not being as good an interviewer, not giving you as good, open, honest stuff. So listen, listen, listen.
And that's not an easy thing to do, really, to listen well. Is that?
No, it's surprisingly hard. If you talk to women female friends who are in dating, they'll tell you a lot of men do not listen well at all.
yes.
And the occasional one that does, they really stand out. So listen when you're doing interviews, and if you're out there dating and you're a man, listen as well. It's an important skill. The other thing I'd say, and this is important depends how you're doing it. In a podcast like this, not so important, but you listen and you also keep your mouth shut. In a podcast like this, we're having a conversation, but if you're doing an interview where you just want to be able to clip somebody and just take them and take your voice out of it, you don't want to be sitting there going, in the middle of my answer, which a lot of people do. That's a natural thing to do interesting. So you need to give all your visual cues with your head. Nod, show me that you're listening, make eye contact, but keep your mouth shut.
Okay.
Here's one more tip, and this is a little different than for a podcast, but certainly you could do it with a podcast too. But if you're doing an interview with somebody who's been through something, take them back to the scene of the place where something traumatic happened to them.
You know, is there any way of summarizing what it is I'm trying to do in an interview? I mean, clearly I'm trying to get to know you, but is there some kind of general rule about what you're trying to arrive at?
That's a good question. And it's good we're talking about this because interviewing is one of the key parts of being a journalist and a story. Mm-hmm. If you're going to share somebody's story, you need to get their story told well. So I guess it's about getting them to open up, getting them to feel comfortable with you. And what you want is to hear their stories, and you want to hear it in a natural, relaxed way. You want mm-hmm. them to forget everybody else in the room, forget that there might be cameras around or big microphones in our face, and just have a conversation one-on-one. And then get them to describe and tell the story in a nice, relaxed kind of way. But to tell the whole story, too, so that the story gets out. So for a podcast, we have a lot more time to talk about stories. I can go into more details. If you're trying to get a story for interview somebody for TV and story, and they might only be on air for 8 or 12 seconds, it would be different, and you'd be really trying to think about getting short, succinct answers to your questions and full sentences as well.
So, you know, as you say, the one-on-one interview is kind of central to news telling, but it's also, I mean, it's a limited format, and yet, you know, there are a lot of studies that show, for instance, if you've got the one boy in the well who fell down the well, for instance, everybody's going to follow that story. But as soon as you move past a certain number of injured or embattled people start to actually lose that connection. So
absolutely.
One person dies, we're there. 1,000 people die, we close it out. So how do you deal with that when you're telling the news? Because so many of the news stories involve those bigger traumas that might lead people just to shut them out.
Yeah, it's a big challenge, and it's, I think, the difference between a really well-told story and not a well-told story. And it's way easier to sit there and throw out the statistics and throw out those big numbers because they're easily available. You pull them off the wires and the internet, and boom, you got them. It's much harder to go out and collect the individual stories, and it's critical. You're absolutely right. It's critical that you do that if you want those stories to have an impact. So let's take, and it's called the identifiable victim effect. If you can identify a victim, we will connect with that victim. People do not connect with statistics. We don't connect with big numbers. Maya Angelou has a great quote, and I'm going to paraphrase it rather than trying to quote her directly. But she says, you know, people don't remember what you tell them. People don't remember what you say. But people always remember how you made them feel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key of picking that one person that you're talking about, because we can't feel for a statistic. We can feel for one person. And when you make that one person human, so they could be from a different country, they can speak a different language, they can look different from you and from your viewers and listeners. But when you can make them human, and there's so much more that makes us similar than different. So if you make them a brother, a sister, a father, a mother, some human level, that's going to make all the difference. And a recent example of that I used with my students in class, first of all, I asked them how many people know about what's going on in Yemen. And I think there's one or two out of 25 smart, young students in a Faculty of Information and Media Studies program who actually knew what was going on in Yemen. They didn't know that Saudi Arabia was largely involved. They didn't know that London, Ontario, where they go mm-hmm. to school, has yeah. a very direct, important connection to that story. They didn't know any of that because those statistics, they weren't there. I mean, they didn't make an impact on them. They weren't gathering them. So I had them read a story that came out in October by Declan Walsh in the New York Times about Yemen. And he went there, and he went past the statistics, and he told the story of a father who had, I might get the number wrong, but let's say about 5 kids. He'd already lost one kid to starvation. He was trying to get the money to take another kid to the hospital. All his other children were malnourished and at risk of dying. And by putting that human face on it and pictures, powerful, powerful pictures, so people could connect emotionally with those pictures, by doing that, the students all care about Yemen all of a sudden. They're mm-hmm. all interested in Yemen. And yes, Yemen is right now the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but that didn't get to them. The picture of the little girl and the story of her father worrying about his daughter dying, that's what got to them. Mm-hmm. And Declan will soon be talking to my students about it because I just emailed him and he offered to talk to them because they're so interested in how do you go out and gather a story like that. And that's the power of telling one story. One person's story or a few people's story rather than just making it about the world's worst environmental crisis, and there are hundreds of thousands, sorry, millions of people at risk of starvation.
I mean, this brings us to what for me is kind of a big question, you know, the idea of telling stories and what you're doing when you tell a story. This is something I think about a lot as a fiction writer, and the thing that I think about most is how much I'm essentially imposing an artificial structure on this chaotic mass of information, and how can you do that and still somehow let the truth filter through? So, you know, you're a reporter, as you say, you may have a minute or two to tell a story. You've got to get visuals in there. It's got to have an impact. How do you manage to avoid distorting truth in that job of storytelling?
Yeah, that's interesting. To some extent, you just accept that you can't.
Uh-huh.
Because you're picking one part of a story to tell. There's no, I mean, if you're doing a video story, you're looking at maybe 3 minutes if you're really lucky. Mm-hmm. Stories on social media are often 1 minute long. You have to pick you have to have a very clear idea of what part of the story you're telling. And I often thought as a TV journalist, my goal should be not to tell the whole story, but to make you care enough about a story so that you'll go to a newspaper or somewhere else and go learn more about the story. So you have to accept that it's limited, and what you can do is limited. And even when you're telling a 2,000-word story about Yemen in a text using photos, you're limited too, and you're telling just part of the story. So I think there's kind of accepting that. And then it's dealing with individual stories and the ethics that come up with them. So a story that comes to mind for me with that kind of challenge is when I was in India, pretty early on in my time in India, a really interesting story broke, and it became a bit of an international story about the dowry system there. So in India, it's very common, even though it's illegal, for families to provide a dowry when you're marrying your daughter to another family. And it becomes, those dowries can be very expensive for each family. And you actually have a bigger dowry depending on how qualified the man is that you're marrying often. And the story that broke when I was, and it's illegal, but it's widely, widely done by a lot of people. It's not done by everybody, but it's a pretty common idea. And I will say too, just to provide some balance, the idea of a dowry was a good one. It was a way of making sure the woman inherited some money, because the men would inherit the money. The son would inherit the money. So it's a nice idea to give some money to give this family off, but it becomes quite crippling to the family who has a daughter, and it makes people not want to have daughters. And there's actually an expression in India that says, raising a girl is like watering your neighbor's garden. So from that is this whole dowry system. That's the background on it. Then there's Nisha Sharma comes along, and she's about to get married. It's her wedding, and the celebrations have started, and her fiancé's family suddenly makes some demands for more dowry, and she gets scared, and she thinks they're threatening her father, so she calls the police. And she becomes a celebrity all over India, and, you know, CNN was picking up the story, like it became an international story, because there she was, one young woman standing up against the dowry system saying, no more. My family should not have to pay to marry me off. I should marry a man because he wants to be with me, and we should be equal. That's how the story was told. It was like super great story, and that's a good thing. Women in India needed somebody to celebrate that cause. However, what most of the story skipped over, because you have to keep it simple, you have to keep it uncomplicated, have a good and a bad, is the fact that her family had already paid a huge dowry to this guy. I went to her house. One room was just filled with boxes. Ovens, fridges, a car that wasn't in the room. I can't remember all the different things, but it's like a household full of stuff. And it wasn't like one oven, one fridge. It was two of each, because her husband-to-be's brother was going to get a part of the dish too. Yes. Uh-huh. So two of everything. So they're already playing the game. And then Nisha Sharma steps up at the last minute because they're asking for more, not because she's championing this right from the beginning.
Okay, so it wouldn't have played as well if we knew that.
No.
So that leads to my next question. I mean, how much pressure is there when you're telling a story to make it sellable as opposed to true? So to make it capture, first of all, people's attention, and then to make it hit the right emotional spot so that they don't maybe think about the ambiguities of the kind that you're talking about.
Yeah. It depends what your news organization is and probably who your editor is as well. So in my case, I was working for the CBC for that story. And I had the freedom to balance it a little bit and mention that part, that she had already played the game a little bit, and show it, because I had video, the boxes. Other places are under a lot more pressure. CBC is great because in theory, they're not worried about profits. They're not worried about profits. They're not worried about ratings, but they are worried about ratings. But they have that freedom. Other places maybe don't have that freedom. And I remember an example of that would be working at BCTV when it used to be BCTV, which was the most widely watched TV show in Vancouver at the time. Huge, huge ratings for their TV hour. And I remember sitting with the assignment editor who puts who's the person who's going to put pressure on people for that. And he was talking to a reporter about and talking to us about trying to find a story because it had snowed 5 days in a row in Vancouver. And he wanted this story about how they've already blown the entire snow removal budget for the whole year because of this snowfall. So five different cities that we called within Vancouver said no, it's not an issue. We found one where it was an issue. But when you think about blowing your snow budget for the whole year, you think about the winter. And their budget was actually only till December 31st. And we're about December 25th. I was working over the Christmas holidays. So we went with that story. We didn't mention the fact, the reporter didn't mention the fact that only one city was facing this mm-hmm. problem. And they also didn't mention the fact that the year was going to be over in 4 days. So it wasn't a big deal that you'd gone over budget because you're 4 days from the end of the entire year. But all that pressure was on the person, the reporter from this assignment editor, to make that story sound super sexy. Like, there's a big problem. Mm-hmm. Our budgets are running out because of the snow.
So how often does that happen, do you think, in the news?
I mean, in a small way, probably all the time. Uh-huh. I mean, probably every reporter is doing that, trying to make their story sound a little bit better and a little more interesting. But there's a difference between what every reporter is doing, the small differences we make, and try to make a story sound compelling and engaging, which I think you have to do, and being misleading and knowing that you're being misleading like that. That, I hope, happens less, but uh-huh. it depends who, again, it really depends on your editor and also who the what news organization you're working for. I'm sure people at Fox get pressure to put people on who are pro-Trump, uh-huh. and I'm sure people at MSNBC or CNN get people to put pressure on that are anti-Trump.
I think a lot of people have the sense that we're in a kind of apocalyptic moment, media-wise, with that kind of polarization,
yeah.
the whole idea of alternative facts, the sense that the truth isn't out there in the way that maybe it once was. Is this, in fact, the situation? Are we in a worse situation now than we were in the past? And if so, what can we do about it? And if not, is there anything different about the present moment than the past moment?
That's something we could spend an entire term talking about. So it's as an educator and a journalist, that's something that makes me want to pull my hair out and makes me crazy because it's hard to deal with and it's overwhelming and it's changing so fast.
Uh-huh.
Some things aren't changing. Like, it's not new that there is misinformation out there. Mm-hmm. It's not new that governments are misleading people. That's not new. The Vietnam War was based on a lot of misinformation and lies, and that's how the government justified it. If we go back in my lifetime, I remember the Iraq War, the second Gulf War, and yes. the whole argument about weapons of mass destruction.
And even the first one, the incubator story, I don't know if you remember it.
No. Is that from Kuwait?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Which was totally fabricated by sort of the U.S. propaganda machine, but really galvanized the U.S. to support the war.
Yeah. And using one, that's a good, going back to what we talked about earlier, that's using one small example. Yes, Iraq invaded this whole country and there's lots of people involved, but we care about that little incubator story and the babies and the, mm-hmm. yeah, the second Iraq war was about weapons of mass destruction mm-hmm. and that was unbelievable if you weren't in the United States, but the media went along with that in the United States, and people I know and like and friends believed it. I was living in Europe at the time, and it didn't seem believable at all that there was a real threat of weapons of mass destruction. It's not new. The problem with false information is not new, but what's new is how open it is. I think what's different now is there's a few things that are different. The United States has a president that is very, very loose with the facts, likes to exaggerate, and sometimes many people would say arguably lies. Certainly mm-hmm. speaks a lot of, he certainly gets a lot of facts wrong without question. There's no denying that.
Yes. We can't say if it's intentional or not, but yep. we suspect.
Yeah. I think he's very smooth and smart about, I mean, to give him credit, about persuasion. I think he's very good at persuasion. I think he knows what he's doing when he's doing a lot of that stuff because he's really controlling the message and he's controlling journalists and he's controlling the dialogue to a large extent. And I don't know it's working so well for him anymore, but it worked well for him for quite a while. It got him unbelievably elected president of the most powerful country in the entire world. So there's that. He's pretty relaxed about those kinds of things. He's made the media an enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember even at campaigning, when he was campaigning to become president, the CNN, anti-CNN chants and booing every time he mentioned CNN, he goes after a lot of main news organizations to discredit them, which is really pretty smart.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not saying nice things about him, so why not discredit him? But it's damaging to the to one of the fundamental institutions that we think of in our democracy, which is a press. And you want to have a credible, trustworthy press, and that gets hard to do when the president's targeting it. So that's kind of new. It's also new that we get so much information from so many different sources.
And now, shouldn't that mean that we get better information and more accurate information?
We think it would be better, more accurate, and more in-depth. No, that's not at all what happens. Unfortunately, it's not. And it's different maybe for the older generation who's still watching TV newscasts and reading newspapers. But for my students, who are, again, in the Faculty of Information and Media Studies, who are probably following the news more carefully than most people their age, they get all the news, the vast majority of their news from smartphones. Mm-hmm. And when you're getting news from a smartphone, they're getting it from Facebook, they're getting it from Instagram, they're getting occasionally from Snapchat, things that are sent to them that are decided by some outside source, they're missing tons of news. It's why they don't know what's going on in Yemen. It's why there's so many stories that I bring up with them that they're not aware of because it's not popping up on their phones and Apple's not putting it on their phones, so they don't see it. So what they do see is things that get clicked on a lot. Uh-huh. And if you're very good at storytelling and you just want to get clicks, you could make up a story that would be much more compelling than an accurate, truthful, factual, fact-based story, and that will get shared with a lot of people, and that comes misinformation as well. So no, I think unfortunately it's the opposite of that. We're getting there's a lot of stuff that out there that is not trustworthy and accurate, and that gets spread and mixed up with everything else, and it allows people to criticize kind of the older, more traditional and trustworthy news organizations.
So what's the way forward? And I mean, this is particularly pressing for you as a teacher. So you've got these journalism students. How do you prepare them to go out into this very different world of media so that they can actually get the right stories out there?
I wish I had a really good answer for that. I think I can give you a partial good answer for that. I mean, I can teach them how to tell good, accurate, truthful, honest stories that are credible. I can teach them the fundamentals of journalism, which don't change no matter what the technology is, which is, you know, process of verification, trying to tell balanced stories, understanding that there's not a single story. You've got to get different sides of a story, not just two sides sometimes. Understanding that stories are complicated and trying to take the time to understand them. I can do that, and they can go off and do that. But that doesn't mean that that does anything to counteract all the other stuff that's out there that isn't what they're doing, that more people might be seeing than what they're doing. So that's the challenge. And I do not, unfortunately, have a good answer for that. I mean, I make them aware of it. Yeah, it's a big challenge, not just for journalists, but for anybody who cares about having an informed public, because when you're getting misinformation thrown in there with truthful information, everything, people end up not trusting anything, which I think is happening more and more, unfortunately.
And are people going into journalism in the same numbers as they did in the past?
Well, that's an interesting thing. Our numbers were down for a while, and this is, you know, our graduate program at Western for journalism. We've done two things that have turned it around. Well, sorry, we've done one thing and one thing has happened that's turned it around. One is we've realized that journalists are almost, not almost all, but a lot of journalists are going from journalism into communications, which is not new, mm-hmm. but it's new that it's happening so much more because the industry in journalism is challenging and the demand for people who can work in public relations and media relations and communications has gone up a lot and keeps going up. I think the last number I saw, there was like 6 people working in public relations for every journalist in this country. So there are jobs out there for them. So we've created a program where we teach them journalism and communications. So that's gone up.
In some ways, public relations is kind of the opposite of journalism.
That's an interesting debate. And I would say no. They're actually much closer. Yeah, no, I think, when I was in journalism school, the public relations was called the dark side.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of it's kind of shameful to go over to the dark side. I do not think that way at all. Having actually spent a year in communications, but also fallen industry. Yes, public relations for McDonald's, I hope I'm not going to get sued, or Shell, or, you know, certain companies potentially might not be doing, you know, super noble work all the time. But doing public relations for the NGOs out there, there's a lot of really great organizations, nonprofits, within our city, within our country, within the world. And if you're doing communications for Doctors Without Borders, like one of my graduate journalism students is doing in South Sudan right now, I don't think he's doing the opposite. He's trying to tell stories just like what we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
focusing on identifiable victim effect, trying to find one person in that refugee camp to tell their stories so that people will care about what's going on in South Sudan, put pressure on their government to get involved and do something about it. And South Sudan is another one of those countries that I asked my students about. Nobody knows that there's bad things going on there. They don't know anything about it. They couldn't find it on a map. And yet there's, it's one of, you know, one, again, a huge humanitarian crisis going on in this world right now. And it's a problem that we don't care about it and know about it because, unfortunately, that message isn't getting out there. So if better people, not better people, if the United Nations or Dogs Without Borders or other people who are there working were more effective at communications, at public relations, and getting their message out there, mm-hmm. then maybe we would get some more help for Yemen, for South Sudan, or whatever other issue might be coming up in the world. So I think doing communications is important work, for sure. And it's not the opposite of journalism. It's very similar. You're telling stories about people. It's just telling stories with an agenda. So in that sense, it is different than journalism. It's not trying to be objective.
Or maybe you're just admitting the agenda, whereas in journalism,
sure,
you're pretending to be objective.
That's a good way to put it. Yep. You're just being front. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you're, I mean, you sound hopeful for the future. You're not feeling that we're at a drop-off point in terms of
journalism. No. I mean, okay, I'm going to come back to that. I just thought of the other point, which was the other thing that's helped journalism is President Donald Trump of the United States, our admission essays. People are often starting to mention that they're realizing that the importance of information and good reporting. And they mention that in their admission essays when they're trying to apply to our program now, because he's actually motivating people to want to go into journalism.
So we may see a pendulum effect from what seems now like the end of journalism as we knew it may be a rebirth moment.
That would be nice.
The importance of it.
I like that spin on it. And now I have an agenda. I'm a journalism instructor. I want people to come to our program. So sure, I'll be forward with my bias. I would like to take that optimistic point of view and share that. I think there are all sorts of challenges to the industry, but I think people are realizing that it's important. Maybe it's not going to be a Watergate moment, but when Watergate happened in the United States, a lot of people got really inspired to go into journalism mm-hmm. back in the 70s when journalists took down President Nixon. So yeah, no, I'm hopeful. It's going to change. I don't buy into this, all the naysayers who say journalism is dying. It's a dying industry. It's being disrupted in a huge way. So many industries. I mean, yeah. The next huge industry that's going to be completely disrupted is the automobile industry. When electric vehicles take over, mm-hmm. it's going to be a massive change. But that's going down the road. There are tons of industries that are being disrupted, like journalism, and it presents huge challenges for us. But people will still want information. There's still a need to get credible information. There's still a need to hold power to account and to be informed about the world. How we're going to do that, what it's going to look like, I don't know. I can't predict what the next internet is going to be. There'll be a new way of delivering information, too, coming up in the lifetime of my students, for sure, that we can't even think of right now. So that'll pose a whole new problem. And we're still trying to deal with the disruption that's occurred because of this.
Well, this has been fascinating for me. I don't know how I did as an interview, but I appreciate the primers you've given me. And I feel like I've learned a lot about the state of journalism. So I want to thank you for speaking to me today. And I want to congratulate Western on hiring you and giving students access to someone like you with such broad experience in journalism.
Thank you very much. That's very nice. I will give you some I'll write up your feedback and send it to you with your grade, and I'll get that to you. And if you want to meet for one-on-one meeting afterwards, I'd like to expand my teaching and be happy to give you some more feedback on that. I thought you did very, very well. I felt very comfortable being interviewed, which I shouldn't have been.
I'm hoping for a B or better.
All right. Yeah. We'll get you into the A level. Don't worry.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Nina. Nice talking with you.
I'm Nino Ricci, and this has been Who Do You Think You Are? A Western University podcast.